Hi, I'm Kyoko. I'm from Japan. Listening to the world is one of my morning routines. The world helps broaden my horizons. I really love listening to the world. Thank you.
If you are like Kyoko and the world is part of your daily routine, we hope you'll join her in donating today. Listener support is crucial for our show. It allows us to bring you the best in international reporting with our mix of rigor and empathy. You can visit theworld.org/give to donate. That's theworld.org/give. Every bit helps and will get us closer to our goal of raising $25,000 by June 14th. Thank you so much.
Hey there, a quick favor. We are conducting an audience survey, and we'd be really grateful if you could take just a few minutes and answer some questions in the survey. Please visit survey.prx.org/world to take the survey today. Again, that's survey.prx.org/world. And thank you.
As Russia makes gains in Ukraine, there's pressure on NATO to revisit a policy that's been in place since the war began.
NATO opted not to provide direct lethal assistance. It has not crossed that line.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, we'll look at where that stands. Also, South Korea dropped leaflets over North Korea. Then North Korea deployed hot air balloons to dump bags of trash over South Korea. But compared to past expressions of hostility, trash bombs might not be so bad.
The idea that this is what they've kind of settled on for now is, to me, a much better place than where we were a few years ago.
Also today, how to explain the war in Gaza to kids.
These are all conversations that have to happen.
And South Africans go to the polls. That's all ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for being with us. Today, millions of South Africans are voting in what's being called the most important election since the end of apartheid in 1994. For the past 30 years, the African National Congress is the party that's dominated South African politics. For the first time ever today, the ANC might not win the majority of votes in the National Assembly, which ultimately chooses the president. As part of the world's global election coverage, our Africa correspondent Halima Gakandi has been at the polls in Johannesburg today.
There were very large crowds at the polling stations that I visited, which was a bit surprising because in the past, voter turnout has been declining, but it seemed like there was a lot of energy around this one. That said, there were also some issues at polling stations across the country, including ones I visited, including late openings and really long wait times, which voters tell me is unusual for South Africa. 30-year-old Thando Mshlanga tells me she waited for 2 hours.
The experience at this particular polling station hasn't been great. There's a lot of confusion inside. People are getting frustrated. I think they could do better.
They being the Electoral Commission in South Africa. And this was Mshlanga's first time voting. And I asked her, why now?
We need change in this country. I was prepared to spend all day if it meant I need to spend all day here. We need to get the ANC out. We need new leaders. Our economy is a mess. We do not have jobs. Me, for instance, I haven't had a job for the past 5 years.
And this is a sentiment that I've been hearing from so many South Africans. They are fed up with how the ANC has led the country for the past 30 years. And for the first time, it feels like their vote might actually remove them from power.
So why are people so fed up, as you said, with the ANC?
Well, there have been a lot of issues in South Africa over the past 30 years, mainly economic issues, high poverty, horrible unemployment, especially for youth, a lot of corruption scandals, crime, the theft of public resources, and infrastructure troubles. And that last one is something that 26-year-old Justin Bendeman mentioned when I spoke with him at a polling station, although he didn't reveal who got his vote today.
I hope to see better service delivery. Obviously, we have big water issues, infrastructures. You know, pretty much nowhere to electricity.
So a lot of frustration there on a number of counts, infrastructure, jobs, economy. Is there any support for the ANC right now?
Yes, there still is. Despite many other people being fed up, the ANC is still likely to be the leading party in this election, even if they don't get that absolute majority. And 56-year-old Leslie Dikenny, he's a longtime ANC supporter, and he tells me why he still has faith in the party.
Mistakes have been done, but most importantly, there's so much that we've been able to gain. the fact that you're able to vote, the fact that I'm able to stand here and speak to you and to walk on these streets, it's because of the African National Congress.
So who are the biggest contenders other than candidates running for the ANC?
Well, there are dozens of political parties represented in the elections happening today, but by far the largest opposition party is the Democratic Alliance, or DA, which could get around 20% of the vote. And that's who Patrick Gilfillan voted for. He's 32 years old.
They're the only official and legitimate opposition to the ANC that are capable of running a government in South Africa. They've proven they can run a government in the Western Cape.
And Western Cape is where Cape Town is located, but largely the opposition is quite scattered.
When should we expect to get election results, Halima?
Well, we're expecting results as early as Friday or over the weekend. And just a reminder of how this will work. South Africans are voting in members of the National Assembly, which is 400 lawmakers, and it's those lawmakers who will vote for the next president. So if the ANC wins 50% or more of the National Assembly, then it will still be them who determines the next president because all a candidate needs is 50% of the vote. But if they do not, which again would be historic, then what we'll expect to see over the coming weeks is opposition parties negotiating, competing, and making coalitions to try to agree on who they want to put forth as South Africa's next president.
So potentially some horse trading and coalition building to come. We will look forward to getting the updates from you. The World's Halima Gakandi is in Johannesburg following the national elections in South Africa. Thanks for the update, Halima.
Thank you, Carolyn.
Farmers in the Rio Grande Valley in Texas are staring down a grim summer as water levels in reservoirs there are at an all-time low. That's because Mexico isn't meeting its treaty obligation on the amount of water that should flow through Rio Grande tributaries into the U.S. Martha Piskoski reports on Texas for Inside Climate News. I asked her to describe how the water shortage is affecting farmers in the Rio Grande Valley.
So in February this year, the last sugarcane mill in the Rio Grande Valley shut down. So that was a big wake-up call. Farmers just realized they weren't going to have enough water to plant sugarcane. So far, you know, I think some farmers are planting less acreage, and there have been drought disaster declarations to get more aid into those counties. But, you know, they're calling on their elected officials to do more. So it's really urgent in the Rio Grande Valley.
And so farmers are largely feeling this water pinch because Mexico is not upholding its treaty obligations to deliver enough water through the Rio Grande and its tributaries to the U.S., correct? What are they supposed to be allowing through, and how much is actually getting to reservoirs in Texas?
Right. So the water treaty on the Rio Grande, Mexico sends water to the U.S., and then the other side of the deal on the Colorado River, the U.S. sends water to Mexico. So Mexico has a 5-year cycle to meet its obligations, and right now we're in year 4, but they've only sent about 1 year's worth of water. So they're very far behind, and it's unlikely that by next year they're going to be able to send all the water that they're obligated to under the treaty.
You've written in your coverage that drought, climate change, and politics are all at play here. I want you to spell out all three of those factors. Let's start first with drought and climate change. How are those impacting this issue?
Right. So the Rio Grande, it starts up in Colorado. So we're seeing the impacts of climate change there with less snow melt, just less runoff into the river. But then it's actually tributaries in Mexico that provide most of the water for South Texas and the Rio Grande Valley. But we're also seeing just higher temperatures, less rainfall. So this drought is impacting both countries. And then with climate change, that's only expected to exacerbate through the rest of the century.
So you're saying that the Rio Grande starts in Colorado, but there are tributaries where the water's actually flowing from Mexico into the U.S. Can you spell that out a little bit?
Right. So the Rio Grande, I kind of think of it as almost two separate systems. So from Colorado down through New Mexico to where I am in El Paso, that's one system, and that's a lot of runoff from the Rocky Mountains. But then after El Paso, the river almost entirely dries up most years, and there's a stretch that's dry through the Big Bend area. And then you get down to Presidio, Texas, and that's where the Rio Conchos joins the Rio Grande. So that's the biggest tributary in Mexico, and that river provides a lot of the water to then kind of refill the river. So when you get down in the Rio Grande Valley, once again, you see a big flowing river. So those tributaries in Mexico play a really big role for the Texas portion of the Rio Grande.
So we talked about drought and climate change as factors here. What about politics? Mexico has national elections this weekend, which I'm sure is impacting this.
Right. So this has become a big political issue in Mexico. You know, you don't hear Biden or Trump necessarily talking about the water treaty. Most Americans probably haven't heard of it. But, you know, the current president, López Obrador, he spoke about this in a press conference recently. And the opposition candidate, Xochitl Gálvez, she says the treaty terms need to be renegotiated. So Mexico has basically been waiting for the elections to happen before making any big moves.
So summer is starting. What do you expect this season to look like in terms of water for agriculture, as well as municipalities in the Rio Grande Valley that rely on this water?
You know, this isn't the first dry year by any means, but it's getting really bad this year. And there are also towns and cities that they get their water from the river, and that water moves through the irrigation canals. So you really need irrigation water to move that water up to the municipalities. So, you know, there's concern that some places they might need to buy water from other municipalities to make up that difference. And we're just going to have to wait and see how it plays out.
Reporter Martha Paskowski in El Paso, Texas. She covers climate change and the environment for Inside Climate News. The global trade war over electric vehicles seems to be ramping up. Like the U.S., Europe is trying to keep inexpensive EVs from China from flooding its markets. It's imposing tariffs and threatening legal action, while China is looking for a way around those obstacles. Well, it might have found one, an abandoned factory in Barcelona. The World's Jerry Haddon reports.
Chinese EV maker Chery got the red carpet treatment last month in an idled plant once used by Japanese carmaker Nissan. Chery executive VP Zhang Guibing told gathered workers and politicians that Chery's joint venture with Spanish carmaker Ebro will create thousands of jobs. It will gradually develop into an industrial park, he said, for manufacturing our electric cars and components. When it's fully operational, he said, we can start exporting cars to other parts of the EU. That goal, exporting EVs across Europe, is why Chery's here. It's still much cheaper for Chery to build its popular cars back home, but the cost of exporting from China into the EU, that might soon become really expensive.
Global markets are now flooded with cheaper Chinese electric cars, and their price is kept artificially low by huge state subsidies.
This was European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen last fall in Brussels, warming up for this announcement.
The Commission is launching an anti-subsidy investigation into electric vehicles coming from China.
That investigation's now nearly done, and China's state-subsidized electric car makers fear one possible follow-up, high import duties, like those the U.S. imposed just 2 weeks ago.
I'm determined that the future of electric vehicles will be made in America by union workers, period.
U.S. President Joe Biden signed an executive order raising tariffs to 100%. With the West closing ranks, China's foothold on the old continent could turn into a strategic win for Chery and other brands like BYD, which has announced plans to open a production facility in Hungary. In Barcelona, car workers are celebrating. When Nissan left shortly after the COVID pandemic, it laid off 1,600 people. The Chery Ebro joint venture is hiring back 1,200 of them, among them Rosa Jimenez. When Nissan fired us, it was like the roof just caved in, she says. My husband was also let go. Suddenly, we had no income, she says, and with two kids and a mortgage. Now Jimenez is back at the plant. She meets up on break between classes on how electric cars work. When the Chery plant opens next year, she says, she'll be back on the assembly floor. Jimenez says she hasn't been following the EV tensions between China and the West, but she likes this Chery model. I think the best is for the cars to be built from zero in the countries where they're going to be sold, she says, because of all the jobs. It's ideal. were happy Chery's chosen Barcelona, as is Chery, no doubt, with its soon-to-be tariff-free electric cars in European showrooms. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
As Russia continues to make slow gains in its war with Ukraine, NATO members are intensifying their support for Kyiv. Just ahead, our interview with the U.S. ambassador to NATO. You are listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. More weapons from the U.S. are starting to reach Ukraine's front lines. But Ukrainian soldiers say restrictions on how those weapons can be used are preventing them from beating back Russian advances. The Biden administration won't permit Ukraine to use U.S.-supplied weapons to attack targets inside Russia. Now, there are calls from within NATO to lift those restrictions, including from French and Polish leaders and from NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg in this interview with The Economist.
This is self-defense. Self-defense is enshrined in the UN Charter. It's legal. It's legitimate. And we are helping Ukraine with upholding that right. And that should include the ability to also strike targets on Russian territory.
Earlier today, we reached out to NATO headquarters in Brussels to speak with Ambassador Julianne Smith. She's the U.S. permanent representative to NATO. I asked her if the U.S. was considering allowing Ukraine to strike inside Russia with U.S. weapons.
Our position remains unchanged. We continue to flow as much assistance to Ukraine as rapidly as we can. We do not encourage strikes on Russian territory. We're focused on pushing, using the weapons they have to push Russians out of their territory. That said, I think you heard loud and clear from Secretary Blinken on his recent trip to Ukraine that this is ultimately Ukraine's fight. They will need to make a determination on their own how and when to use the capabilities and the weapons that they have in hand. We trust them and we leave it in their hands. But as for the U.S. position, it remains unchanged, and I don't have any breaking news on that front.
Other countries, though, are changing their position on this. The UK, Finland, Sweden, and Poland have already given the green light to drop these restrictions. The Dutch defense minister has said that not giving Ukraine the option to use Western arms in Russian territory forces it to fight, quote, with one hand behind its back. Is the sentiment outside of the U.S. generally shifting in that direction?
I think what we've seen over the last 2+ years is that each member of this alliance has made its own sovereign determination on A, how it wants to support Ukraine, whether it's a mix of humanitarian, economic, or security assistance, and B, whether or not they want to place any restrictions or provide details on how those weapons should be utilized. So we leave it in the hands of the nations themselves that are providing assistance. Again, each country makes its own determination. That's a sovereign decision. But it doesn't detract from the unity that we have here across the NATO alliance, where the resolve to support Ukraine is certainly as strong as it ever was. And I am confident that when we get to the Washington summit this summer in July, what you're going to hear is additional forms of assistance, new deliverables for Ukraine, and a way to build a proper, well-lit bridge to membership for our friends in Ukraine.
This week, Ukrainian military officials announced that France plans to send military trainers to Ukraine. They have since walked back that declaration, saying they're still in conversation. But should NATO countries rule out sending trainers into Ukraine?
When the war started, the NATO alliance made a pretty clear decision, and that was that NATO would not be party to the conflict. NATO opted not to provide direct lethal assistance. It has not crossed that line. Nothing has changed in that policy. NATO is not coordinating the provision of lethal assistance in any way, shape, or form at this juncture. And there is not talk across the alliance right now of actually sending NATO trainers into Ukraine. Individual member states are looking at the question of whether or not they want to provide additional trainers, either through training outside Ukraine or whether or not they would consider training inside Ukraine. But one of the things that we are looking at as a potential deliverable for the Washington summit is actually the possibility of the alliance providing coordination of all these different training efforts that are ongoing. So yes to coordination of training, but no to the possibility of NATO sending trainers into Ukraine.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has continued to remind the West about his nuclear arsenal. Is that bluster or something more?
Well, since the beginning of the war, we've seen the Russians do or conduct a considerable amount of nuclear saber rattling. We take this very seriously. We're monitoring the situation day in and day out. We discuss the situation as it relates to their rhetoric. What I will say, though, is from a U.S. perspective, we are not seeing an indication at this juncture that Russia is preparing to use nuclear weapons, tactical nuclear weapons at this juncture. But we have warned them that we view this type of rhetoric to be dangerous and irresponsible. And so the messaging that has come across from the alliance, I think, has been crystal clear. But the U.S. is not in a position, nor our other allies, to really shift our strategic posture in any dramatic way. But I will assure you that this is something that we take very, very seriously. We don't brush it off. It's something that's closely watched and monitored across the entire alliance.
The bottom line here is that while the U.S. and other NATO nations have so far avoided being pulled directly into this war, NATO's posture toward Russia has been shifting. Does that make a full-fledged war between Russia and NATO in Europe a growing possibility?
We have done everything in our power to enhance deterrence and defense across the alliance so that we can protect NATO territory and deter any form of Russian aggression. As soon as Russia went into Ukraine, we took a series of steps to move thousands of troops into Eastern Europe. We established 4 new multinational battalions, and we have worked tirelessly to enhance our defenses and our policies to counter hybrid tactics like disinformation, like malicious cyber attacks, and we're working to protect critical infrastructure across NATO territory. I think Russia knows full well that we take deterrence to be our core mission here. We've messaged them loud and clear what the consequences would be if they touched NATO territory. And so far, we believe that the deterrence is working across NATO territory. Unfortunately, in Ukraine, it has not stopped the Russians from continuing to wage this unprovoked war of aggression inside Ukraine. But right now, we assume and feel rather confident that Russia understands the risks of entertaining the idea of attacking NATO territory.
That was U.S. Permanent Representative to NATO Julianne Smith. She spoke to us from Brussels. More global news and stories are still ahead this hour. Stay with us. You're listening to The World. Small businesses in Cuba will soon have access to foreign capital through American bank accounts. But it is a baby step.
Make no doubt about it. U.S. sanctions are still very tough. The Cuban population continues to suffer dramatically under the broad U.S. sanctions policies.
That story and more ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. People in South Korea who live near the border with North Korea got a warning on their cell phones today, telling them to watch out for objects falling from the sky. The alert was referring to plastic garbage bags, more than 250 of them, according to South Korea. They were sent across the militarized border from the north by hot air balloons, and they were filled with actual garbage, as the world's Matthew Bell reports.
North Korea sent a warning about this a few days ago, saying that the South will soon have mounds of waste paper and filth scattered around the country. And so when the balloons started dropping garbage bags today, South Korean authorities were not taking any chances. This video from the Times of London shows a bomb squad carefully approaching a couple of garbage bags lying on the ground. Local resident Yi Si-yun told the newspaper she actually heard the thing hit the ground. It was loud and it sounded huge, Yi said. What if it wasn't just rubbish, but instead some viruses or chemicals? Apparently, these garbage bags contain stuff including waste paper, cigarette butts, old shoes, and, according to one South Korean news agency, manure. In some ways, this is nothing new, says Victor Cha of Georgetown University.
There has always been an information and propaganda war between the two Koreas, but the stuff they're sending in the balloons obviously is a little bit new, and it's probably in response to the resumption of so-called balloon launches by South Korean NGOs into North Korea.
Typically, those balloons drop anti-government leaflets into the North, along with USB thumb drives containing South Korean movies and music. Victor Cha, who's also with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, says North Korea's dictator, Kim Jong-un, sees these sorts of things as a threat.
There's a joke in the Korean expert community that the North Korean leader is more afraid of BTS than he is of American nuclear weapons, BTS being the South Korean K-pop boy band. But I think there's truth to that.
Cha says the thing that Kim Jong-un is most afraid of is losing the loyalty of his own people.
And they clearly crave information from the outside. They're human beings that don't want to just be told how to live every millisecond of their life, but want to be able to experience and see things outside of their country. He knows that that's there. And he knows that if one blade of grass pops up, then many more blades of grass will pop up between the cinder blocks of repression and suppression that the regime puts on its people.
That's why North Korea is so angry about the balloons from the South. This is something the government in Pyongyang has complained about for years. The previous South Korean government outlawed the practice, but last year, a court in the South struck down the law. The current government is also willing to take a more confrontational approach to North Korea. Jenny Town is with the Stimson Center. She says the government in Seoul is unlikely to stop activists from sending balloons to the north, but the response from there could have been much worse.
There are other ways that they have responded in the past that were much more belligerent, that was threatening military action. So the idea that this is what they've kind of settled on for now is, to me, a much better place than where we were a few years ago.
After nuclear negotiations collapsed in 2019, North Korea restarted its weapons testing activities. The following year, Pyongyang named South Korea its number one enemy. And it's worth pointing out that the two Koreas remain officially at war because no treaty was ever signed after the Korean War ended more than 70 years ago. For the world, I'm Matthew Bell.
In Taiwan, the U.S. has appointed a new diplomatic representative. Veteran diplomat Raymond Green is set to take over from Sandra Oedkirk beginning this summer. The American Institute in Taiwan essentially functions as the U.S. embassy there and made the announcement today. Green's installation comes as China boosts its threats against Taiwan, where a new president wants the island to maintain its self-governance. The Biden administration has announced a change that will allow some Cuban business owners to open bank accounts in the United States. This is a first. Biden has said that the change is meant to ease economic hardship for Cubans who want to start private small businesses, something that they've only been allowed to do since 2021. Richard Feinberg is a professor emeritus of international political economy at UC San Diego. He explains what Cuban business people will be able to do now that they could not do before.
So they will be able to open up direct accounts in U.S. banks, which should facilitate buying goods in the U.S. and dealing with customers from the United States. They will also have expanded access to the internet. It'll be easier for them to access certain social media platforms.
How important are small businesses to the Cuban economy today? What kind of an impact might this rule change have?
The small-scale business in Cuba is definitely the most dynamic sector by far. It consists of about 11,000 what we would call small-scale firms that employ about 250,000 people. And in addition to that, there's about 600,000 mini-businesses. Add that together, that's about 20% of the Cuban labor force.
So what types of businesses are opening up now since small private businesses were allowed starting in 2021?
They're opening up in a number of areas: construction, hospitality, including many restaurants that American tourists love to visit in Havana, software development, which is very dynamic because they have some good computer and science schools there in Havana, athletic facilities, accounting firms, food home delivery, a variety of small-scale businesses. They are quite dynamic. They pay their workers much higher salaries than do most of the state-owned businesses in Cuba.
The U.S. continues to designate Cuba as a state sponsor of terrorism, and sanctions still are in place. How does this change affect the way U.S. banks might deal with Cuban businesses?
Well, make no doubt about it. U.S. sanctions are still very tough. Most U.S. firms cannot do business in Cuba, neither just trading or investing. So the Cuban population continues to suffer dramatically under the broad U.S. sanctions policies that have been in place now for many decades. These new measures, though, do make it somewhat easier for the private sector to thrive. But the major constraints on the private sector in Cuba are lack of U.S. tourism and the general depressive nature of the overall economy in Cuba. I have to say, current U.S. sanctions policy is still responsible for those restrictions that do hurt the private sector in Cuba.
So this is maybe a smaller change, you know, as opposed to the bigger change, which would be lifting sanctions.
Absolutely. Lifting the sanctions remains the elephant in the room, and that's something the Biden administration does not want to touch for fear, presumably, of further annoying the Cuban-American community in South Florida.
How do you see this news being received in Cuba by regular people, by people who own their own businesses, and also the Cuban government?
The private sector, of course, will welcome these measures, which will help them do business. Also, ideologically, the U.S. government is clearly saying that the United States believes that the emerging private sector in Cuba is an important step forward towards a more pluralistic, open Cuban economy, and ultimately a more pluralistic Cuban society. So that's very welcome news from the point of view of people working in Cuba. The government itself will continue to criticize the United States for its overall sanctions policies and for favoring the private sector over the state sector. Nevertheless, they must see this as something which helps at the margin the Cuban economy and therefore perhaps indirectly take some of the pressure off of Cuban policymakers.
Do you foresee any unintended consequences or changes for Cubans that go beyond what's being talked about here?
Well, in terms of migration, there's been massive out-migration from Cuba in the last several years because of the economy being so depressed and there seeming to be no hope on the horizon. But now that this private sector is looking somewhat more promising, I think some Cubans who might have just closed up their tents and decided to emigrate might decide to stay and try their luck in the private sector in Cuba.
You mentioned, you know, the Biden administration not wanting to anger Cuban-American voters. Some U.S. politicians have criticized this regulatory change. Republican U.S. Representative Carlos Jimenez of Miami accused the Biden administration of blatant complicity with these dictators. What's your take?
Well, I would strongly disagree. I would say the private sector is largely independent of the government in Cuba. People like Jimenez argues that the private sector in Cuba is just an extension of folks in the Cuban government. That is incorrect. I've met many of these private sector folks myself in my various visits there, and I can assure you they operate largely independently of the Cuban Communist Party or the Cuban government. All around the world, the United States supports an emerging private sector, even in authoritarian circumstances, because they see that as a future towards a more open and pluralistic economy and society.
Richard Feinberg is a professor emeritus of international political economy at UC San Diego. He was explaining there new U.S. regulatory changes designed to increase support for small businesses in Cuba. In the 1980s, nearly 200 people were detained and disappeared in Honduras, and their families have been marching ever since to demand justice for their loved ones. It's been 40 years, but now there is a chance the families may see reparations. An unprecedented bill is working its way through Congress that would provide monetary compensation to them. For his podcast, Under the Shadow, reporter Michael Fox traveled to the capital of Honduras, Tegucigalpa, to look at the legacy of the U.S. role in the region.
I'm standing in the middle of Merced Plaza. It's right in front of the Merced Church in downtown Tegucigalpa. And it's called the Merced Plaza, but it's also known by another title, and that is the Plaza of the Disappeared.
Nosotros la hemos tomado desde 1982.
We have been marching in the plaza since 1982, says Berto Oliva, the founder of COFADE, the committee of the family members of the detained and disappeared in Honduras. We've been demanding justice there every first Friday of the month for 40 years, she says. See, in the 1980s, Honduras wasn't immersed in war like its neighbors, but the government was authoritarian and violent, and the United States fueled that violence. It used Honduras as the staging ground for military operations in the region, and it founded and trained the country's notorious death squad, Battalion 316. It took action against student and radical leftist organizers. Berta Oliva's husband was one of them. Back in June 1981, she witnessed the death squad kidnap him. They had only been married for 4 months. She was 3 months pregnant. I was there when they took him away from me, she says. I'm a witness to the brutality. I'm a survivor of that moment. Berto Oliva founded COFADE the next year, alongside other family members of the detained and disappeared, to honor their loved ones and demand justice. The COFADE headquarters today is in a two-story colonial building near the Merced Plaza, where they've been holding their monthly demonstrations for decades. Upstairs is COFADE's own memorial to the disappeared.
Eduardo Becerra Lanza, Samuel Perez.
Oliva walks me around the room. The walls are covered with black and white pictures of many of the nearly 200 people who were disappeared in Honduras in the 1980s. Along the far wall hang several banners depicting the faces and names of many of them. At the top are written the words in Spanish. You took them alive. We want them back alive.
Yo lo considero como mi templo. Y al ser mi templo, es mi templo sagrado.
This place is sacred, says Oliva. When I'm feeling tired or weak, I come here and I find strength. I communicate with them. Today, COFADE's fight for justice may pay off.
Y me acaban de entregar en este momento la iniciativa de ley.
In early April, Congress began debating a bill that would see justice for the victims of the state violations of human rights during the 1980s. Lawmaker Oved López Rodríguez spoke out in favor. He's a member of the governing leftist Libre Party. Many countries in Latin America have already advanced with this type of legislation, he said. Many countries have already done justice, not us. We still have these conservative sectors that don't want us to debate this issue here. All of the lawmakers that spoke that day echoed López Rodríguez's sentiments. But the bill has opponents, both in and outside of Congress, who believe that the country should just move on and leave the past in the past. But COFADE will not let that happen. Outside of Congress, members held their monthly rally. They carried signs and banners. Germán Pérez was just 4 years old when his father was disappeared in 1982. We're just in front of Congress, where they're holding important meetings for a law to create the necessary policies to look for justice, he says. It's late, but it's important for those of us who have long been fighting for this. Félix Molina is an independent Honduran journalist who today lives in Canada. He fled the country in 2016 after an attack on his life. He says there is a window of opportunity at the moment under the government of President Xiomara Castro.
Esta iniciativa de reparar las víctimas incluye los principios de la justicia transicional.
This initiative to compensate the victims includes the principles of transitional justice, he says, which is greatly absent in the Honduran scenario, which is why the historic wounds of the evils caused by the state remain open. This is important. If approved, the law wouldn't just compensate victims, but would create public policies to remember the past and ensure it is never repeated. This is something COFADE has been working on independently for years.
Pero eran demasiado los testimonios. Demasiado como para...
Last December, COFADE inaugurated a new museum north of Tegucigalpa. It's called the Museum Against Forgetting. It's in a former clandestine detention center where people were held, tortured, executed, and disappeared. That's part of a video made for the inauguration. In the video, Berta Oliva sits along a white wall with tiny marks on it. She says that when they did the tests, they found that these were bloodstains. They've hidden the past from us, she says in the video. And now, it's like we're opening the windows to the past. And that is what her group is hoping Congress will do as well. For The World, I'm Michael Fox, Tegucigalpa, Honduras.
This story comes to us from Michael Fox's history podcast, Under the Shadow, about U.S. involvement in Central America. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Since October 7th, kids all over the world, including here in the U.S., have been exposed to horrifying images and stories. First from Israel during the Hamas attacks, and since then from Gaza under Israeli military fire. Parents and teachers have had to figure out when and how to begin to explain the violence. Iranian-American author Reza Aslan writes about religion and politics. He also has four children. So he was inspired to write his latest work called A Kid's Book About Israel and Palestine to help other parents talk about the conflict in Gaza. He was in Los Angeles when we spoke earlier this week. Reza, this book is clearly a children's book. There are bold graphics and simple language and short sentences. With a subject that is so highly charged, why did you decide to take this subject on?
Well, honestly, it began with just something that I wanted to write for my own children. As you say, I mean, this is a conflict that is unavoidable, and even more so now that it has inflamed college campuses across the United States. And I think that a lot of kids are being inundated with a lot of information, some of it misinformation. They're getting a lot of prejudices and stereotypes at school from their fellow students or teachers or other parents. And I thought that it was really important to give them a context for where this conflict came from.
Can you just describe what this book looks like and reads like? It is not a picture book, but it is meant for younger audiences.
Yeah, it's a book that really uses the text as a part of the experience of it. So there are different colors of text, different sizes of text, but there aren't a lot of images except for maybe a couple of maps to help situate children. This book is presented in such a way to create a base understanding of the history of this conflict, to help parents and children understand how we got to where we are today.
Was there something in your own family that triggered you wanting to write this book? Was there a question that came from one of your kids or, another catalyzing moment for you?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, we had just left church one Sunday and there was a very emotional display outside of the church, a series of children's shoes representing the thousands and thousands of children in Gaza who have been killed in Israel's retaliatory attacks, nearly 14,000 children so far in the 7 months of this conflict. And I think that they had a very difficult time processing what that display was about, understanding the horror of this war. And I think that was the spark that made me realize my own children. I mean, I do this for a living. I talk about religion and politics for a living. I deal with the Middle East for a living. And my own children barely understand what's going on. And I just figured if that was the case, then I'm sure there were many other parents just like me.
Your book is basically a very pared-down, simple history lesson of the Middle East that might actually be useful for adults to read as a refresher. But there is, you know, so little middle ground and a lack of a shared narrative about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. What were your struggles in trying to provide a neutral primer? For example, you know, the book has the word Palestine in the title, and a lot of news organizations, including our own, prefers terminology such as the Palestinian territories.
Right. It's very difficult to give equal weight to both national narratives, because so often accepting one of these narratives leads to denying or erasing the other, right? Simply taking on the Israeli perspective often means just simply denying the Palestinian perspective and vice versa.
Mm. As both a parent and a religion scholar, how do you decide when kids are old enough to take this topic on?
My wife and I made a decision very early on in our children's lives that we were going to challenge them with complex issues. We were going to try to create in them this sense of belonging to the world, so that when they are bombarded with racism or sexism in the media or amongst their communities, they are primed to reject those ideas. They have already developed the skills necessary to be able to think critically. They have the ability to maintain very complex ideas and to grapple with them. And as long as you present them, as I say, in an age-appropriate way, they will surprise you with their sophistication.
For Jewish and Muslim children in particular, people's perceptions of what's happening in Gaza might shape interactions they're having here. Is that something you had in mind as you wrote this book?
If I were to be perfectly honest with you, I don't think that this book is necessarily designed for either Israeli or Palestinian families, or even necessarily Jewish or Muslim families. Those families, in many ways, are stakeholders in this conflict. They can't avoid talking about this conflict. This book is primarily for all those other families, that giant mass in the middle that is bombarded with images and information about this conflict from all sides, and which truly does not know how to respond. This book is an opportunity for them to get a firm grounding in the history of this conflict, how we arrived to where we are now, without necessarily erasing either side, so that they can talk to their kids about the way in which they themselves are getting this information from multiple sources.
You use the word peacemaker a lot in this short book. What does that word mean to you, and what do you imagine it might mean to the younger generation?
I think that if kids can learn the importance of dialogue and compromise and peaceful coexistence, if they have the ability to see both sides of this conflict, to understand how the world might look different from someone else's eyes. That's it. If you can get that, if you can understand that, then you have the ability to navigate the complexities of this world. And most importantly, you have what it takes to change it for the better.
Reza Aslan writes about religion and politics, usually with adults as the audience. His new publication is a kids' book about Israel and Palestine. Find all of our reporting about the war between Hamas and Israel at our website, theworld.org, or hear more of our coverage wherever you listen to podcasts. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Be good to each other out there and join us right back here tomorrow. Before we say goodbye, I'm popping in to remind you that The World is fundraising now through June 14th. We'd appreciate it if you'd consider making a recurring gift today to keep our nonprofit newsroom running. You can head to theworld.org/give to donate and learn more. That is theworld.org/give. Thanks so much. From PR.